on November 15th. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KUBOO Portland. The time is 4:59.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Let Us Grow on Friday, November 4th at Mercy Corps in Portland. Let It Grow celebrates the work of bringing education and the experience of gardening to incarcerated youth and adults in Oregon's correctional facilities. This event features the premiere of the documentary Can You Dig This? And a panel discussion after the film. Again, that's Let Us Grow, a benefit for growing gardens, taking place Friday, November 4th at Mercy Corps, 45 Southwest Ankeny Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Liberian Gospel Music Awards on Saturday, November 5th at 2 p.m. at PCC Cascade Auditorium in Portland. The Liberian Gospel Music Awards ceremony is dedicated to fostering an appreciation for the historical development of Liberia gospel music artists. Again, that's the Liberian Gospel Music Awards, Saturday, November 5th at 2 p.m. at PCC Cascade Auditorium, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information about the performers and schedules can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. And now, your KBOO Evening News.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Surveillance Corporation's monitoring Standing Rock may not be licensed. We take a look at who's on the ground in North Dakota.
Oregon Health and Sciences University is being sued for fraud and animal abuse by the U.S. Department of Justice.
And on News from the Boo, we have a two-part super show. Journalist Kristen Yount traveled to Pakistan to study the politics of water. We interview her live about what she has learned, plus the station's in-house trainings on interrupting oppression are growing. We speak with the two women leading the effort.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. The U.S. Department of Justice has filed a lawsuit against OHSU claiming that the government was overcharged by the university. The suit claims that OHSU charged a facilities and administration fee based on their Portland facility when, in fact, the research was done at the Oregon National Primate Research Center in Beaverton. The government is seeking damages and penalties. The university has countered that they were given approval by the government before applying the rate. OHSU's Primate Research Center is also the target of an open investigation by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for possible violations of the Animal Welfare Act. This is not the first time the university has had a run-in with the USDA. In 2012, they were fined $11,679 for animal abuse and received additional warnings of possible violations in 2014 and 2016.
Multnomah County Elections Bureau says tomorrow, that's Thursday, November 3rd, is the last day to put your ballot in the mailbox and be sure that it will arrive in time to be counted. Ballots can be mailed with one first-class stamp. Ballot envelopes must be signed and ballots received by the elections office by November 8th at 8 p.m. Postmarks do not count in Oregon. All registered voters should have received their ballots. Registered voters in Multnomah County who have not received ballots or who need assistance should call Multnomah County Elections at 503-988-3720 or visit the elections office at 1040 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. Voters can sign up to track their ballot this year. Text, email, or voice alerts tell voters when the county elections office has mailed ballots, and alerts remind voters to return their ballot and say whether the ballot has been accepted or whether it will require further action by the voter. Multnomah County voters can sign up for these services by visiting multco.us/elections/track-your-ballot. Across the state of Oregon, drop off your ballot in person at any of the official 24-hour drop sites located throughout your county before 8 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Voters can also drop off their ballot at any county library location during regular library hours.
The School of African Roots started up earlier this year as a local education project of a small coalition of radical community organizations. Back with us today to talk about how it's going, we have with us Jamila Bordone and Ajamu Umi from the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Thanks, both of you, for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So the last time we had you on here talking about the School of African Roots, it hadn't even started yet. Now it's open. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. It's something the community needs, and the whole idea is consistency. And a lot of projects that happen, a lot of efforts, people say they're going to do it and then they drop out for some reason. You have to ask those organizations. But for us, we had the breakfast program and we did it for a little over a year and it was needed in the community. People said, oh, this is what we want. And so we moved to the School of African Roots and people are really appreciative of it.
Great. And for those who don't know, tell us briefly what the breakfast program was.
So we started it, of course, in the tradition of the Black Panther Party, who started free breakfast in this country before the Panthers. There was no free breakfast in any public schools. So we did it because they taught us when they did it that it was a great way to connect with the community and to get the community to be able to engage the community in conversations about the things that we need to organize ourselves to create capacity to create a better world. So it was a way to build relationships. You know, I always joke with people, it was never about the pancakes, it was about the relationships. And from those relationships, the parents in North Portland made it clear to us, like, we need an independent school. So that's where the School of African Roots came out of for us.
And what ages of students do you have at the school?
Well, the school is open for young people from the ages of 6 to 18. We actually had a couple of kids who were younger, but the average is about 10 to 12, I would say.
And where are you located, and when do students meet?
So we meet out of the Abbey Arts Center, which is at 7600 North Hereford, H-E-R-E-F-O-R-D, Avenue in North Portland. And we meet every Sunday from 12 to 2. The programs vary because it is a coalition effort. This coming Sunday is the APRP's monthly session. So people should contact us if they want to know so they can get a list of what's going to be going on each Sunday.
Can you walk us through, different things happen all the time, but can you walk us through what might students be doing on a typical day?
Anything from geography, science, mathematics. The key is really paying attention to the cultural initiatives that are going on. We really want children to understand what's at stake in terms of the injustice system that's going on, but we want to do it in a way which humanizes children. We don't want to talk at children. We don't want to be above children. We're here to work together with children. And so One of the things that we did was we took some hair, and so they combed hair, and then we ran it against water to show how the water moves. And so that's one of the things we did, and talked about how Mali was the birthplace of science. And so we just did a lot of things like that. And we're going to be talking about the notion of consent this coming Sunday. So those are really important issues. They're in the news, as we all know, but we want to make it relative in terms of the culture that we belong to.
And then just to add really quick, so, you know, we recognize there are a lot of really good teachers that teach in the public school system, but we also recognize that the system, the way it's set up, just like this country, the way it's set up, it's not really designed to be about truth and justice. So, you know, just for full transparency, like, we are engaging these children in a struggle around ideas around justice. So, like, this election that's coming up, we're talking to them about the history of that. Like, the African people and other people who died and were beaten for the vote, they understood clearly that voting was a tactic. And like any tactic, you change it based on its effectiveness. And so we're engaging the students around this rhetoric that, you know, voting is a principle. If you don't do it, you're selling out to humanity. That's not the message we're giving them. We're giving them the message that if that's what they want to do, that's great when they get older. But the most important thing to do is that they dedicate time to engaging in work to organize their communities for self-determination. And to say that the only way to do that is voting is to say that the work of Marcus Garvey, the work of the Black Panther Party, the work of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, all these groups was irrelevant, which certainly is not true. So that's what we're doing with these children, is we're challenging them to think, which is something that is unfortunately not a common practice in this society.
And so also look at the idea of being a student as something which is lifelong. A lot of people look at education as this regimented idea. It's from kindergarten to 12, and then you go to a university. And the process that we're doing is to assure that that education is a lifetime for these children and that they continue the work after they graduate.
And how are students reacting as they engage with some of these perhaps gaps in their education?
Oh, the children are so positive. They're reacting wonderfully to it. And they tell their parents, oh, you want to go back to the school? And it just really encourages us to, as people interacting with the kids, to do more of that work and to make sure that they come out of this with compassion, that they come out of this with a sense of humanity.
And in the bigger picture, what impact are you hoping that this is going to have on the larger community?
So, you know, again, we see the most important thing that people can be doing is getting organized and developing community capacity to solve problems. We don't believe that the police are going to solve our problems. We believe they create problems for us. We don't believe that the Department of Human Services can solve our problems. We don't believe any of these institutions can solve our problems. We think that we have to solve them. And the way to do that is getting people together to first understand the problems, then to engage in activity to organize and create capacity to address them. And this is tied to our bigger mission. Like, we're an international organization. We're a Pan-African political party that's based in Africa. So a big part of that is getting people to look towards what's happening in the world and understand that what we do in North Portland is a part of what's happening in Uganda and Tanzania and Ghana and Britain and so forth, and that we need a concerted effort worldwide to address the problems that we face.
Speaking of which, Ajamu, we understand that you are traveling to Zimbabwe. We have a couple minutes left. Do you want to tell us what you're going to be doing there?
Actually, it's Tanzania. But next month we'll be traveling to Tanzania, myself and Comrade Adrian here and our chapter here. And our purpose for going there is twofold. We have a chapter there, an emerging chapter of the AAPRP in Tanzania and Dar es Salaam and Arusha. So we want to go there and connect with them again, building relationships, do work there, the work that they're doing in the Pan-African clubs that they're building there, help them to solidify their relationship to the AAPRP. And then just on a personal level, like, as I edge towards retirement, I'm looking for the spot where I want to spend the rest of my life in Africa. So I'm searching for a spot there as to where I can go and spend the twilight years of my life.
Well, how can people support some of this great work you're doing?
Well, bring your children to the School of African Roots. That's one way. continue to communicate with us. It's a family situation. It's not just you drop your kids off. The parents should also be involved in this process. This is a community effort. The other thing, financially, there are different organizations involved in the School of African Roots. So you can talk to each organization if you like. For us, we do have a website. It is AAPRPPDX.
It's AAPRPOregon.org.
Okay, great. Well, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much, Jamila and Ajamu. You can connect with them on Facebook at the School of African Roots or once again online at www.aaprporegon.org. Thanks.
Thank you. Forward ever.
Backwards never.
Last Tuesday, Portland Housing Commissioner Dan Saltzman announced that the plan to house homeless people at Terminal 1 has fallen through. The city council voted 5-0 to resume the sale and abandon the attempt to lease the property as a mass homeless shelter. A proposed outdoor shelter on Southeast 104th Avenue also appears to be in limbo. Oregon Live had reported that Homer Williams, the builder behind the Terminal 1 plan, doesn't consider the proposal dead and may press on with the plan in a different form. But earlier today, the Bureau of Environmental Services announced that they will resume the sale of the property effective immediately. Tomorrow, the property will be listed with a commercial real estate broker who will be accepting bids on the property through Friday, November 18th. Mayor-elect Ted Wheeler has indicated that a suitable resolution to the homelessness crisis will require more than one site.
Portland houses that are 100 years old or older cannot be demolished but must be deconstructed and recycled, according to a new city ordinance that goes into effect today. Restore Oregon, the advocacy group that pushed for the legislation, reports that more than 300 single-family homes are demolished annually in Portland, with the average home being 1,400 square feet and amounting to 42 tons of landfill waste. Portland State University's Northwest Economic Research Center also projects the ordinance will result in about 50 new jobs and $1.5 million added to the local economy. Grants of up to $3,000 are available to help homeowners cover costs associated with deconstruction. KBOO's Tony Glamour Tramp LaTigra spoke with Peggy Moretti from Restore Oregon for more.
The deconstruction mandate is one small facet of a whole lot of other things that we are working on to collectively curb the demolition epidemic in Portland. So we never looked at this as kind of like a magic bullet. It was just one of many smaller things that collectively would help us address and minimize some of the demolition going on. In terms of what we ended up with here, I think the only thing that we would like to see expanded about it is we would like it what's the word I'm looking for? It's for houses that are 100 years old today, built in 2016 or earlier. So we'd like to see that raised so that more houses become eligible for the mandatory deconstruction. But the reason it was sort of put where it is because there needs to be the capacity to receive and salvage and reprocess all of those materials. And so we didn't want to flood beyond the capacity of the market to take those materials and reuse them. So there's a capacity that has to be built up.
And my understanding is that this ordinance so far is unique in the nation. Is that still true?
That is definitely our understanding. I mean, I can't say with 100% certainty that we didn't miss something, but to the best of our knowledge, it's the first one.
Okay. And in general, can you say anything about like how homeowners or developers, I guess, have responded to this ordinance, or is it too early to say that?
We've heard comments back that some folks... I think the general consensus across various groups is that this is a positive idea. It is acknowledged, though, that it does add cost to the demolition. And honestly, that's part of the intent here. We think it should cost you a little more money to tear down a historic house. It should cost you something to dump that many tons of waste into a landfill. It costs us something to throw away that mass quantity of materials and embodied energy. So We are intentionally making it a little more difficult to demolish something so that the proper consideration is given to whether or not that house or that property could be restored and reused. Preferable in our mind, salvaging an old house is your course of last resort after you have exhausted every option for preservation and reuse of the property.
That was Tony LaTigra speaking with Peggy Moretti from Restore Oregon. Find out more about their work online at www.restoreoregon.org.
At 5:45, followed by Kitchen Table Conversations at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be a little bit of sunshine with highs around 64 degrees. Today in history, on November 2nd, 1947, millionaire Howard Hughes flew the biggest airplane ever built at the time, the Spruce Goose, also known as the H-4 Hercules, for the first and only time as it took to the skies. It was made entirely of plywood. Today, the Spruce Goose is a tourist attraction parked in McMinnville, Oregon, at the Evergreen Museum. The company, which incidentally acquired some of its planes from the CIA's Air America fleet, used by the intelligence agency to conduct covert surveillance on China in the 1950s and early 60s. Our quote of the day is from Howard Hughes, who said, "Every man has his price, or a guy like me could not exist." Hughes also once said, I'm not a paranoid, deranged millionaire," which proved to be somewhat untrue.
An African-American church was burned to the ground last night and the ruins spray-painted with the words, "Vote Trump." The Hopewell Missionary Baptist Church in Greenville, Mississippi, was 100 years old and sustained major damage in the fire. It is being investigated as a possible hate crime. The Associated Press reports that Kristen Clark, president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, described the church as a cornerstone of a majority black community. She told the AP, quote, "The toxic rhetoric of this election cycle continues to cast a dark cloud over this election cycle."
Tiger Swan is one of several security firms under investigation for its work guarding the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with Smog Blog investigative reporter Steve Horn about security and surveillance at Standing Rock.
So Tiger Swan, this is a private security company that was hired to run intelligence on behalf of Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, where the ongoing protests and encampments continue and have been going on for months now, actually since April. So it's going on well over half a year that these encampments have been in place, and they're growing in North Dakota. At least it seems like from media accounts. I haven't actually been on the ground yet, but I will be going there soon to do some on the ground reporting. But so Tiger Swan, interestingly enough, is a security contractor that worked both in Iraq and Afghanistan on behalf of the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and anyone else. Basically, it's just a contractor who will do any work for hire. But in particular, what I found interesting about them was the work they did on behalf of U.S. occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan on behalf of the State Department.
So,
and then also,
they're mercenaries, right? Basically,
mercenaries, right? So, I mean, it is, of course, it's important to point out two things. On top of that, they've actually advised and helped the company Blackwater, which is the kind of known as the world's most powerful mercenary arm, or it was. It's changed its name several times since then. I think it now goes by the name Academy, but that's the company that the investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill wrote a whole book about Blackwater. So they've been business partners and collaborators with Blackwater. But also what ties all this together is the fact that on the ground in North Dakota, there is a very visible extreme militarization of the law enforcement presence on the ground. You can see that in pictures. You can see that in videos. And so a company like Tiger Swan being there, not exactly shocking given what we can already see, but this came out because there was a report that the Morton County in North Dakota, which is the county in which these protests are taking place, they put out a report basically looking into whether or not any of these out-of-state contractors were working without a license in North Dakota. And in outlining the different companies that were there, one of the ones that came up in that report was Tiger Swan. So you can see that report is in my piece. It's not really the most fascinating report, but one of the beyond one finding in there that said that the dogs that were unleashed on activists in early September, right before Labor Day, which went viral because of Democracy Now! And the video they got, those dogs and that company were operating in the state without a license, and they may be, they are subject now to a criminal investigation and may face charges. And so Tiger Swan was mentioned within that because they're outlining everyone that was there, including that dog company, which the company's name is Frost Kennels, different company, but part of the same private security conglomerate operation that's on the ground there on top of the out-of-state officers who are there, which is a whole different story. But the combination of lots that, you know, they point to lots of out-of-state activists are there. This isn't local people. But at the same time, you look at the law enforcement, the private security that's there, it's also not very local. It's lots of out-of-state cops, hundreds of out-of-state cops. Dozens upon dozens,
and that's
of
because
more
of that,
out-of-state security.
Right, you mentioned that in a previous, there's a actually a law passed 20 years ago or so.
Correct. Yeah, called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which is what is the other piece of legislation passed in 1996 that's allowing a lot of these militarized, state-funded cops to be there from several, I think half a dozen different states, including the one I live in Indiana, my former home state, Wisconsin, Ohio, Nebraska, and a couple others, South Dakota. So it's in total, it's I think I saw that North Dakota just asked for $4 million more dollars from its state coffers to pay these out-of-state people. They're also asking for federal funding, and they can do all this because of this Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which passed 20 years ago, signed into law by President Clinton. And it was signed into law actually under the auspices of preventing basically climate change disasters or hurricanes. But now it's being used in a completely different way, that is to quell and stop and disrupt these protests in any way possible.
In a Tuesday evening interview with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, Libertarian vice presidential candidate William Weld essentially endorsed Hillary Clinton. In response to a question from Maddow, he acknowledged that he and Gary Johnson were not going to win the election, but noted that it was important that they achieve the 5% necessary to obtain matching funds and future ballot access. When she followed up with a question about whether a voter in a contested state should vote Libertarian and risk a Trump victory, he replied, quote, "Well, I'm here vouching for Mrs. Clinton, and I think it's high time somebody did." He said that he's known her professionally for 40 years and that she's a person of high moral character. He called her honest and reliable, despite Trump's ranting to the contrary. The Libertarian ticket of Johnson and Weld is currently polling at about 10% nationwide.
The Higher Presidential Committee on Church Affairs in Palestine has condemned the raising of an Israeli flag at the eastern entrance to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, also known as the Church of the Resurrection, in Jerusalem. The committee says it's a clear violation of the sanctity of the holy site, which is added to the daily violations of Israeli occupation forces against the city of Jerusalem. The Independent Middle East Media Center reports the committee called for implementing the status quo law, which guarantees the rights of all religious communities and groups in Jerusalem. The law prohibits raising any flags on any religious property. Historic Christian churches have been the target of frequent attacks of vandalism and even arson over recent years by extremist Israeli settlers.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Chris Andre, and Tony Glamour Tramp Latigra. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The Cable Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with host Joanne Hardesty. At 9 o'clock, you'll hear Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fogarin speaks with investigative journalist Robert Perry about the U.S.-Russia relations and Washington's consensus and the election. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with host David Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Nyman speaks with essayist Elliot Weinberger about his new collection, The Ghosts of Birds. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk tackles Seedlings, a time travel tale that takes place on the Oregon coast. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
If it seems like this is a little early for News from the Boo, you are correct. We have a special long-form News from the Boo this week. We are not joined by Monica, but rather we have Kristen Yount with us today. KBOO producer Kristen Yount traveled to Pakistan recently as part of a journalist exchange program. She went in part because her KBOO show, Waterworld, focuses on sustainability and the politics of water. Kristen is here to tell us about what happened and what she learned in Pakistan. So first of all, thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, no problem.
So, Kristen, who sponsored your trip, and why were you, in particular, invited to go to Pakistan?
So, it's kind of there's a lot of people that supported the effort. It's the Center for the International Center for Journalism, or the ICFJ, which is, as it seems, a way for journalists to be able to travel to places where they wouldn't normally be able to go. And so that was one part, sort of the agency that sets up the tour. And then our sponsor in Pakistan was a group called UKS, and that's UKS. And the website is www.uksresearch.com. And it was really great because they are a research group that does media research. Specifically, and they were getting ready to celebrate their 20th birthday, their 20th anniversary. And so the director, Tasneem Mahan, was with us and the whole time. And she's a very well-connected person. And because of that, we got to go to places where people just don't go, like the Minister of Information and the Minister of Foreign Policy and the Karachi Press Club and just really cool things like that, that, you know, set the tour really apart from anything you would do as a tourist or anything. I really felt like I was there to learn. So that's the long answer.
Well, let me follow that up with an unfair question, because I'm sure this could take up an hour or more on its own. But if you had to big picture it, what are some of the misconceptions or stereotypes about Pakistan and life in Pakistan that we have here in the United States that you found to be not the case?
Well, it was something I struggled with, you know, a lot the whole time, because I felt that there were a lot of people who were really concerned about me going, including our own State Department, the consulate that is there in Pakistan, the U.S. mission in Pakistan, is very concerned about American safety over there. It's not a place where you would go on vacation. And Americans are discouraged from going. So there was that, right? I mean, that just says it all. You know, I tried to talk to my doctor about getting shots, and she was like, well, what? Why are you going there? That's dumb. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, if you think it's dumb or if you think that it's dangerous, isn't that like part of what makes it dangerous? If you already have this notion that it's scary or that you don't know, all you know is that don't go there, right?
Once you were there, did you feel that those misgivings were wrong, or did you feel that they were justified in some way?
Well, I never become ill, and I never did get shots or anything like that. There is security. People in Pakistan live behind walls. There's been a lot of unrest. I mean, if you can imagine having sort of military coups for the last 80 years or so, what your neighborhood would look like. And there's a lot of barricades. There's a lot of barbed wire and stuff like that. But to me, it just looked like a bad neighborhood. I felt like I had to be careful, but I didn't feel like I was in super bad danger. I don't know. I'm kind of hedging what I'm saying, but yeah.
Well, let's turn now to your wheelhouse, which is water and water issues. As a journalist who's covered water issues across the United States, what was your takeaway on the issues surrounding water in Pakistan?
Well, I did some research before I went, and Pakistan, like a lot of places in the U.S., has water. You know, even though they suffer from droughts and things like that, it's because when you have a lot of rains and then dry weather, and you don't have a lot of infrastructure to catch the water, then you're in trouble. So they need, in general, just generally speaking, over the country, which is a little smaller than the state of Texas, just having more catchment systems and better irrigation systems would help a lot. A lot. And then, you know, that's kind of in general for the country, but in some of in the cities like Karachi, which is a mega city on the coast, there's some serious issues with water because there are so many illegal wells. There are illegal wells and places where people have just broken into the water mains and have started siphoning off water. They're the water tank mafia, and they drive around in these really brightly colored cars, and everybody knows who they are, but if they didn't exist, then people wouldn't have water. So it's like you have to have it.
So with that being the case, is the government actively engaged in infrastructure projects to be able to trap more of their water resources?
Yeah, I mean, there's some things, there's a big dam, and the name escapes me right now, which I'm kind of embarrassed about, but there's a dam that's been scheduled to be built, but it keeps getting pushed back and back just because there's so much foreign investment involved. And this sort of, you know, Pakistan has sort of a love-hate relationship with foreign investors, right? Because it's like, oh, you know, it's such a good idea to have foreign investors, you know, to help us build our infrastructure and stuff, but it's always like, well, how are we going to pay them back if, you know? And they're smart, I think, in general, pretty prudent about things like that, where you see other countries who are not prudent about that at all. So there's that. So, yeah, hopefully. I mean, there is different. There's small. I mean, I went specifically asking, the think tank people, the people who are working in development specifically, what is done on the local level to try and harvest water. And there are things, you know, small projects, regional projects. But I stuck to the city, so I didn't really get to see anything like that.
You also met with the former mayor of Karachi while you were there, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And what did he have to say?
Yeah, Fahim Sakar Khan it was funny because I was at a party and I was talking to somebody that, you know, I was like, oh, I'm here to talk about water. And, you know, all the other journalists on the tour were really interested in security. Which is like boring to me, but so they were like, oh, you need to talk to this guy. And so someone like wrote down his phone number, and then I called him the next day and he actually answered. He was expecting my call. I was like, whoa, this is awesome. And so I got to meet with him, and he had a lot to say, and he's actually going to be on my show on Friday morning at 9 a.m. To talk about water politics in Karachi when he was mayor. And kind of what's going on now. So,
did you see parallels with the water issues there to issues that you've covered here in the U.S., especially here in Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I because you know, like the whole bottled water thing, and you know, when your water goes bad, then people who make bottled water make a lot of money. And I drank a lot of bottled water there. In fact, that's all they serve in restaurants and stuff. Especially in Karachi, you don't drink the water. And it's 24 million people not drinking the water. So, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people do drink the water. But as, you know, as guests, they strongly caution us not to.
So it's a cautionary tale on what happens when you allow
Absolutely.
Your infrastructure to degrade and you instead look to private industry for your only supply of water.
Uh-huh, or foreign investment. I tossed around the word privatization of water a few times, and I got a few blank stares, and someone told me, well, they don't really look at it like privatization. They look at it as foreign investment, and they're very much like on guard about it. Like they don't want to just give their national resources away to somebody who's going to exploit it.
As you mentioned, Pakistan, though smaller than the U.S., is not a small country. How much of it did you get to see? Where did you travel to?
I went to Islamabad and Karachi, which are pretty big cities. Islamabad is, everyone acknowledges it's a fake city. It was built to be the capital. It's like a very moderny kind of clean, very clean. They don't have water catchment problems there. You know, it's kids who go to school in Islamabad. The schools are paid for by the federal government. There's a huge national government presence there. It's near Rawalpindi, which we didn't go there, which is where the military has their big center. Mm-hmm. So we didn't. Stayed far away from there. But so it's Islamabad and then Karachi. So just like kind of in the north and then way in the south.
Well, listeners of your show here on cable will want to know what will be your next journalistic focus regarding the politics of water? And what do you see now that you've come back from Pakistan as the flashpoints that really need to be covered?
Well, in the U.S., I'm still really dedicated to looking at the Willamette River and how the EPA is going to come out with a record of decision at the end of the year, supposedly, to see what the plan is like. And I'm super interested in what's going on in North Dakota and around in other places around the world where the water protectors are trying to protect the water. That's what needs to be done. And I'm also really interested in people testing their water and how citizen scientists testing their water could help affect policy. Because I don't know if you know, but the state DEQ is run on a complaint basis.
Well, we are running short on time. So, Kristen, on behalf of everybody at KB, welcome back to the States, and thank you for going over there and covering these issues. That was Kristen Yount. You can listen to her show, Water World, this coming Friday, November 4th, from 9 to 10 a.m., and you can catch her interview with the former mayor of Karachi on that show, correct?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
We are halfway through a special double edition of News from the Boo, our weekly program on Wednesdays, when we hear from folks inside of KBOO about happenings around your independent community radio station. Going to switch gears now and talk with Delphine Crescenzo. Welcome.
Hello, Erin. Thanks for having me.
So we've had you on the show quite a few times, but for listeners who might not be familiar with you, remind us of your role here at KBOO.
Well, so I'm a programmer. Right now I contribute on a podcast called Profiles with Carlos Chavez. I'm also an engineer. I actually will be engineering the next show, Kitchen Table Conversations. Mary Postlewaite will be hosting at 6 o'clock. I also help with training, and I'm involved with the board. That's a good time to make the announcement that I'm actually the current board president. President of the KBOO Foundation.
Great. And speaking of training, tonight we wanted to talk a little bit about the Beloved Community and Interrupting Oppressions training for staff and lead volunteers. So what are these trainings?